listening to the BBC History Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. First up, U.S. Voodoo Scare. From sexual orgies to Satan incarnated as a snake, lurid depictions of voodoo in North America long titillated and shocked readers. As David G. Cox explains, they were also wielded as justifications for racist oppression during the social and political upheavals of the 19th century U.S. Spirit in the Sky. A Haitian painting of the powerful voodoo creator spirit Dambala, the Sky Father. Dambala was one of the many deities and beliefs originating in West Africa that traveled with enslaved peoples to the New World, where they influenced religions such as voodoo. On January 2, 1893, the Black American abolitionist and reformer Frederick Douglass delivered a lecture on Haiti to an audience in Chicago. It was widely alleged, he reflected, that the Caribbean Republic was riddled with voodooism, fetishism, serpent worship, and cannibalism, and that little children are fatted for slaughter and offered as sacrifices to their voodoo deities. Such claims, Douglass declared, were false. He told his listeners that while serving as U.S. minister, effectively an ambassador, to Haiti, between 1889 and 1891, he found no evidence of ritual sacrifice despite diligent investigation. By the time Douglass spoke in Chicago, the idea of Haitian voodoo as a murderous cult was lodged in the American public consciousness. As he noted, the features of this myth would have been familiar to many. According to scores of white writers at the turn of the 20th century, voodoo was an imported African religion devoted to the worship of Satan, incarnated as a snake. Voodoo ceremonies, it was claimed, consisted of frenzied dances, sexual orgies, and the ritual sacrifice of animals or humans, followed by the consumption of their bodies or blood. The priests and priestesses of this imaginary faith were said to be the real rulers of Haiti, holding all of its citizens, from presidents to peasants, in the grip of terror. In 1901, claims about Haitian voodoo coalesced in a widely reprinted newspaper report on the demonical orgies of this purported devil's cult. Supposedly reproducing the findings of the famous American geologist and traveler Robert Hill, the author of the piece claimed not only that large number of young children are offered up annually in Haiti as sacrifices to the great yellow snake, but also that mothers frequently dedicate their infants at birth to this purpose. The article provoked an incredulous response from Ebenezer Bassett, who, as U.S. minister to Haiti between 1869 and 1877, was the first Black diplomat. Having lived there for more than a decade and speaking fluent French, Bassett, like Douglass, could claim authority on the question of Haitian religion. As Bassett knew, the whole story about cannibalism in Haiti is no more than a myth, which, like other myths, has gained credence by persistent repetition. Casting doubt on the veracity of the report, he noted that Robert Hill had refuted the existence of Haitian cannibalism in his recent Caribbean travel narrative, and that the claims of the article were in full accord with, it is better not to say that they were probably based on, Sir Spencer St. John's book, Lurid Inventions. Spencer St. John was a British diplomat and a former charge of affairs in Haiti, and the book in question was Haiti, or the Black Republic. First published in 1884, it made a deep impression on U.S. journalism, providing the blueprint for a plethora of articles that, though claiming originality, did little more than summarize, in increasing lurid terms, its lengthy chapter on voodoo worship and cannibalism. Up to this point, I have placed voodoo in quotation marks, not only to suggest that it was a figment of white imagination, but also to differentiate it from voodoo, the African-derived religion generally practiced by Haitians, spelled V-O-D-O-U. Much of this religion can be traced to West and West Central Africa. It contains elements of the religion practiced during the era of slavery by the Aja and Fon peoples of the Bight of Benin. Voodoo, V-O-D-U, is the Fon word for spirit, as well as of others from the Kingdom of Congo. However, traditional voodoo was not, as 19th century white commentators claimed, a direct African import. It was a product of the New World melting pot, a dynamic blend of the religions of enslaved Africans and the Christianity of the European slavers. In this respect, voodoo has much in common with other Black diasporic religions, including Cuban Santeria, Brazilian Candomblé, and Jamaican Obeye. Like those, voodoo helped people of African origin survive the brutality of the Atlantic slave movement. In the Victorian age, white people on both sides of the Atlantic ignored the vibrant realities of voodoo, dwelling instead on its demonic imagined double, voodoo, V-O-O-D-O-O. Why were they so keen to defame Haitian religion? Frederick Douglass had the answer. Haiti is Black, he declared in Chicago. And we Americans have not yet forgiven Haiti for being Black. Between 1791 and 1804, enslaved and free people of color rose against the French colonial government of Saint-Dominique. The revolution resulted in the abolition of slavery and independence for the colony. Renamed Haiti, it became the world's only Black republic. Desperate to demonstrate that people of African descent were incapable of self-government, white supremacists spent the next century defaming Haiti, presenting it, in the words of Douglass, as a very hell of horror. As the 20th century approached, the idea that the world could be divided into races whose members shared the same essential traits was widely accepted. Thus, to opponents of Black freedom in the U.S., Haitian voodoo, V-O-O-D-O-O, became proof that without white control, Black Americans would degenerate to savagery. As Douglass reflected, the Black American could never part with his identity and race, meaning that the denial of Haitian civilization was a denial of the possibilities of the Negro race generally. This backlash against Black freedom explains why V-O-O-D-O-O, voodoo, first entered the American popular consciousness during the 1860s and 1870s, just as a series of constitutional amendments secured the abolition of slavery, along with the establishment of Black citizenship and the enfranchisement of Black men. As the author of an 1866 article in the Memphis Appeal proclaimed, voodoo was beginning to take hold among the Negroes. Free them from the check which was once held over them, they have unlimited control over their baser passions, and now and then it bursts out and proves that the worship of their barbaric fathers still runs in the blood of the Americanized Negro. Deluge of discourse. Initially, Americans writing about voodoo, V-O-O-D-O-O, focused on Louisiana, particularly New Orleans. A former French colony, Louisiana had a sizable French-speaking population well into the 19th century. In the 1790s and early 19th century, this population had been bolstered by the arrival of up to 25,000 refugees from the Haitian Revolution, well over half of whom were enslaved. It is thus unsurprising that a reference to an African deity called Vaudou appeared in a New Orleans newspaper as early as 1820. However, from the 1880s onwards, thanks to Spencer St. John, attention turned to voodoo in Haiti. The press was swiftly saturated with reports of the Caribbean Republic as a land of blood, with articles bearing headlines such as Haiti, a brooding nightmare of savagery, bloodshed, cannibalism. It is tempting to see this deluge of discourse as a reflection of U.S. imperial designs on Haiti, which it occupied between 1915 and 1934. However, at the turn of the 20th century, Haitian voodoo was most often invoked by white supremacist Democrats, who argued that Jim Crow laws and regulations, which enacted from the late 19th century, disenfranchised Black Americans and enforced their segregation from white people were necessary to prevent similar savagery at home. The peak interest in Haitian voodoo coincided with legal efforts to destroy the Black vote in the South, beginning with Mississippi in 1890 and ending with Georgia in 1906. Southern legislatures drew up new state constitutions containing a plethora of voting restrictions. These were intended to disenfranchise Black Americans without contravening the 15th Amendment of 1870, which made it unconstitutional to deprive the vote on the basis of race. In the halls of Congress, Democrats, including the Mississippi Senator Hernando Money, cited the work of St. John as supposed proof that the Black American was no more than a veneered savage. To the architects of Jim Crow, voodoo was an ideological weapon. Depictions of Haitian voodoo worship, a potent brew of sex and violence, helped to sell newspapers in an age of sensationalist journalism. At the same time, they reinforced racist notions that everybody of African descent was inherently bestial, criminal, and hypersexual. Depictions of orgiastic worship chimed with the myth that white women were in constant danger of the Black beast rapist, which was used to justify Jim Crow and fuel violence against Black Americans. In a 1914 speech to Congress, the notoriously racist Mississippi Senator James Fardeman made the connection explicit. St. John, he claimed, had presented a disgusting story of the worship of the voodoo and cannibalism, which he says is common as Black sexual crimes in the southern states of this republic. Fears of Black resistance. While ostensibly justifying Jim Crow, American depictions of Haitian voodoo betrayed acute white fears of Black resistance. African-derived spiritual beliefs and practices played a part in almost every slave uprising in North America and the Caribbean. In 1822, protective charms were allegedly distributed among those involved in South Carolina's Denmark Vesey conspiracy, named after a free Black man convicted of planning a major uprising of enslaved people. In Jamaica, a little over 60 years earlier, the use of similar charms during the massive slave insurrection known as Tacky's Revolt prompted a British crackdown on Obeah. For the late 19th century white Europeans and Americans, however, the dangerous character of Black religion was most associated with the Haitian Revolution. By the end of the century, the idea had been enshrined in Haitian mythology that the revolution began with a voodoo ceremony in a forest, during which a pig was sacrificed and blood oath sworn. Though voodoo certainly galvanized the Haitian Revolution, the reality of the ceremony has been debated by scholars, some of whom question the sources upon which the story is based. White supremacists, however, had no interest in questioning the historical accuracy, instead portraying voodoo as a death cult bent on the annihilation of the white race. This accusation chimed with the widespread view that political equality in the U.S. would lead to race war. In 1908, the San Antonio Light published what it claimed was a genuine voodoo chant invoking racial extermination, but which was almost certainly the product of a journalist's fevered imagination. Circulated by those seeking to justify Jim Crow tales of voodoo sacrifice and cannibalism were shot through with white anxiety. These stories may have facilitated a kind of psychological displacement. In other words, real white violence against African Americans was projected as imaginary Black murder in the service of Satan. In the turn of the 20th century South, racial violence assumed unimaginable dimensions in the form of spectacle lynching. Black Americans were tortured and murdered before white crowds that could number in the thousands. According to statistics compiled by the NAACP, the civil rights organization founded in 1909 as the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, at least 1,902 Black Americans were lynched between 1890 and 1910. The affinities between these all-too-real rituals and fictional voodoo ceremonies seem more than superficial, especially if we note, as many historians have, the religious symbolism and sacrificial dimensions of spectacle lynching. This reign of racial terror troubled many white people, undermining their sense that they stood at the summit of human civilization. Condemning the 1904 lynching of Luther Hobart of Mississippi, one newspaper editor wrote, "The Negroes in their most bestial state of voodooism could be guilty of nothing more savage and brutal." The editor's conclusion deliberately inverted the racist language of Democratic politicians such as Hernando Money. "The white man is given too much boasting," the journalist reflected, "but in many instances, he is but a thinly veneered savage." Voodoo gripped the public imagination because while fueling the violence upon which Jim Crow was built, it allowed many white Americans to imagine that it was not themselves, but others who lived in a land of blood. David G. Cox is a lecturer in modern American history at the University of Southampton. His research for this article was supported by a British Academy mid-career fellowship. You're listening to the BBC History Magazine on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Up next, the Nazi War of Words. Hitler and his acolyte, Joseph Goebbels, wielded propaganda as a potent weapon in the battle for German hearts and minds. Lisa Pine shows how posters targeted all sectors of society to promote prejudice and bolster support for party policies. Family planning. The Nazis considered nuclear families to be the building blocks of a pure German nation. The family was exalted in Nazi ideology and propaganda as the germ cell of the nation. In the Nazi Party platform, a 25-point program outlining their political goals, it was declared that the state must ensure that the nation's health standards are raised by protecting infants. This 1936 poster shows the Nazi eagle spreading its wings protectively over the valuable German family. Echoing the eagle, the father of the family has his arms around his wife and one of his children. The mother holds a baby in her arms, while a third young child smiles out at the viewer. "The NSDAP protects the national community" is the headline slogan, with furthering wording proclaiming that national comrades could turn to their local NSDAP group for help or advice. The Nazi Party did indeed provide assistance and counsel to families, provided that they were deemed pure Germans, hereditarily healthy, and of good blood and character. Owning the airwaves. Encouraging universal uptake of radios, the Nazis hijacked broadcast media for propaganda purposes. Radio offered a convenient way of streaming propaganda and speeches directly into homes, so unsurprisingly, the Nazis were keen to ensure that as many Germans as possible had their own radios. Hence, the People's Receiver, a range of low-cost sets developed by the government from 1933. "All Germany listens to the Führer with the People's Receiver," proclaimed this 1936 poster, one of several designed to encourage take-up. The implication was, of course, that every proud citizen would be expected to buy a set and tune in to listen to Hitler. And the effort succeeded. By 1939, 70% of German households owned a radio, creating a mass audience for the regime's output. In 1933 alone, Hitler made at least 50 radio broadcasts. Communal listening was also encouraged to heighten the emotional impact of speeches, with loudspeakers set up in town squares and other public areas for this purpose. Driving force. A scheme designed to boost car ownership reflected the regime's plan to motorize Germany. The Nazis were determined that Germany should be a nation of motorists as a signifier of the regime's modernity, speed, and progress. From August 1938, workers were encouraged to save for a Volkswagen, people's car, via the government-backed Strength Through Joy organization, KDF, to make car ownership accessible to all Germans, not just the wealthy elite, who were previously able to afford one. The KDF wagon scheme involved paying installments of 5 Reichsmarks each week for 4.5 years. Posters, such as a 1938 example showing a black Volkswagen with a voucher card, were produced to promote the scheme. By 1939, some 270,000 people had signed up. The Volkswagen was intended as a car for free time and leisure, no longer largely the preserve of the business sector, but a desirable, useful, and enjoyable consumer product. However, the outbreak of the war in 1939 choked the output of the KDF cars, as the economy was diverted to support armament production and factories were dedicated to turning out military vehicles. Female gaze. Posters playing on the fears of economically deprived women during the Depression. At the height of the economic crisis in Germany in 1932, some 6 million people were unemployed across the country, leading to widespread poverty. The Nazis played on the hardships suffered by so much of the population, using posters to declare that not only Hitler and his party could lift the country and its citizens and their families out of the deprivation that afflicted so many. To maximize the impact, campaigns were cannily targeted using images, language, and themes to appeal to specific groups. An example aimed at women proclaims, "Women, think of your children." The picture shows a young family, a dejected, unemployed father, an anxious mother, and 2 small children with the clear message to save the German family. The suggestion being that voting for Hitler was the best way to secure a bright future for nation's children. Fighting talk. Posters were deployed to boost public morale during wartime. In this One Struggle, One Victory poster designed by Hans Schweitzer in 1943, a brown-shirted member of the Stormtroopers, the paramilitary force that played a key role in Hitler's rise to power, joins a Reichsmark soldier in stretching his right arm in a Hitler salute beside swastika flags. The date at the top, January 30, 1933, imply that the war was simply an extension of Hitler's continued efforts right from the moment he took power to make Germany great and to defeat its enemies. This evokes the sense of a continued battle from the early days of Nazi political success to projected victory in the war. The striking, martial, and belligerent poster was intended to bolster endurance among the German people by reinforcing the prowess, fortitude, and ideological determination of German soldiers. It was one of many designed to boost morale and dictate the public narrative about the progress of the war. Anti-Semitic art. Nazi posters painted Jews as the root of Germany's economic and political problems. In Nazi propaganda, the Jew was frequently used as a scapegoat for all that had gone wrong in Germany. In his writings and speeches, Hitler repeatedly blamed the Jews for both the disaster of the First World War and the outbreak of the Second. Using lurid colors to highlight the alarming nature of the Jewish enemy, anti-Semitic posters appeared on the streets of Germany and across Nazi-occupied territories to try to influence the public as they went about their daily activities. A 1943 example by Hans Schweitzer epitomizes the theme and style. It features a caricature of the capitalist Jew presented as a hook-nosed, fat and repellent person in his black hat and suit, wearing a yellow Star of David bearing the word Jew. The text makes no bones about the perceived culpability of the Jews. "He is responsible for the war," it shouts. The word "he" presented in a much larger font size to emphasize who's to blame for the conflict. Amiable occupation. The Nazis attempted to pacify civilian inhabitants of the countries they invaded. The Nazi regime was keen to extol the benefits of occupation to the populations of some lands its troops invaded. For example, in a positively cheerful poster from 1940 by Theo Majeco, aimed at civilians in occupied France, a German soldier is shown holding a smiling French child, munching a piece of bread, with two more French youngsters gazing hopefully up at him. The caption in red and black letters reads, "Abandoned populations, place your trust in the German soldier." Such calculated propaganda, offering reassurances about the occupying forces, belied the truth of their aims. This gentle image of a German soldier was very different from those portrayed on the propaganda posters distributed in Germany, such as one showing a German soldier as ruthlessly determined in the face of his enemies. Slogans intended for German audiences were powerful and memorable: life or death, for freedom and life, perish Judah, victory at any price. Lisa Pine is a fellow of the Institute of Historical Research at the University of London. Her most recent book, co-authored with Keyes Bauderblom, is Soviet and Nazi Posters, Propaganda and Policies, Bloomsbury, 2025. You've been listening to the BBC History Magazine on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is classical Royal British music by D'Lo Sound. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.